parties may be able to be reimbursed if they take on a cleanup. And effectively what it is multiple parties are out there. You end up going to a particular party. They feel that they want to be able to get ahead with it, going ahead with the cleanup. They're not as responsible as they're willing to spend money on. We can reimburse them for getting the cleanup going ahead, so that when you have either unfound parties or unwilling parties participate, we can still have cleanups moving ahead. Now, when we reach such a cleanup, and we find out that once into it, the additional cleanup needs to be done, work has to be done down the road, the same proportion of splits among the various players that have funded a cleanup will have to will remain. Again, as I said, this will be in section 4A, subsection 4A of that section deals with the fact that this agreement must be entered as a consent decree in the circuit court. Now, again, this is at the very beginning. We've reached an agreement with parties, a party or parties, about a cleanup. Once having to reach that agreement, there are some steps we have to go through, but it gets entered as a consent decree with the court. We must provide public notice. This will be in subsection 4D. Must be able to propose public notice so that anybody can comment on it, other potential responsible parties as well as the public, about the type of agreement that we've reached. And of course then we shall in fact allow for that comment to be evaluated. Once we get into the process, we shall, that negotiation process, we determine there's a problem, needs to be cleaned up. We can enter into negotiations with the various parties. We will give them, once we've identified what those responsible parties are, we'll give them 60 days in which they can come forward with what a potential cleanup plan is, so that we can get that agreement reached. We can grant that a 60-day extension. If, however, we're not getting cleanup at that point in time, we can take action to be able to move ahead with that cleanup. Again, we need to make sure the private parties have a chance to participate in the cleanup of their own, under their own volition, but if they don't, the department may take action and does not drag out too long. Okay. Let's see. Let me jump down a ways. There are other key pieces, but let me go to the covenants not to sue. Basically, what we want to be able to do is, once we've entered into certain agreements, questions are, what escapes from future liability are there? And the mechanism to be able to provide that escape from future liability are covenants not to sue. The department may enter into agreements or into covenants not to sue, including future liability, if it's in the public interest, if it would expedite removal or remedial action, and if they're in full compliance with the consent decree. Now that's when we may enter into covenants not to sue. There are two places where we must enter into a covenant not to sue. One is if a responsible party has proposed a cleanup option on site, which they think will do it, and we reject that and require them to move it off site, that we must provide a covenant not to sue. So that if something gets moved up to Arlington off site and problems develop at Arlington, they would be provided with a covenant not to sue, assuming that there was a legitimate on site solution that they proposed and we rejected. Secondly, that if there is a permanent, in the judgment of the department, a permanent solution, that we also would, in fact, would be required to provide covenants not to sue. Okay. The key language, by the way, for the criteria for which we must make determinations before granting covenants not to sue are contained on page 32, and it's the director shall consider A through G in making such a determination. Now, once you provide the covenants not to sue, obviously one of the big concerns are, okay, you're giving escapes from liability. Isn't that kind of a bit open-ended? Well, what the way to be able to address that, the way the federal law addresses that, is to be able to have openers or reopeners in the agreements. And those reopeners are covered in the next subsection area.
What page?
F-A, top of page 33. Now, first off, it will be reopened for conditions which are unknown at the time the original agreement was reached. So if something comes forward later on that we didn't test for, or some other circumstance unknown at the time, it is reopened. So there is not an escape from liability for unknown circumstances. That is a reopener. And that is a mandatory reopener. It may be reopened if there is a failure of the remedial action. That is, an attempted effort to be able to clean it up takes place. We find out later it doesn't work. Then the question is, may it be reopened? And the answer is yes, if we require that. Very frankly, my assumption is that we would require that in all situations. Okay. There is also language that will permit a reopener for anything else determined by the department to be legitimate and necessary for a reopener. Again, the purpose is to be able to ensure that you don't allow people to escape from liability when it's unnecessary. And yet, clearly, there are some areas of need where you've got people spending a whole lot of money. They want to be able to have that site put behind them, and that's what's intended here. Okay, we've marched through the agreement to clean up. Cleanup has taken place under the auspices of the court, that is, in a consent decree. And we're at the end of the process. The company comes to us and says, we are wanting to be able to, I'm going ahead of myself. One other area that we want to be able to have settlements are that you have a party. Kurt described the idea where you've got multiple parties and there's a big soup of a mess. You have some parties that have very small role to be able to play. And what one would then do is have what is referred to de minimis settlements. They really are able to settle with those smaller parties for some level of contribution, or possibly no contribution. That is what would be done here and with covenants not to sue.
What page is that?
Okay. Covenants not, or pardon me, de minimis settlement is page 34, 8A, line 6. Now, on all the covenants not to sue, whether it be from releases from future liability or anything else, those decisions by the department are able to be entered in at the discretion of the department. There's nothing that requires it except for those two examples of the requirements for when they must be entered into. And those decisions are not appealable either to the commission or to the court. Page 35, line 22, we pick up, we're through the process, got all the parties that are responsible, they're going ahead and cleaning up, there have been covenants not to sue, the people that have had a very small role to play have been settled out, they're out, and we've got a site action's been completed. Within 90 days of such notice, the director shall determine whether or not the site is cleaned up and so certified. Before certifying, there is another chance for public comment, so that the public or other interested parties be able to come forward and say, yes, we agree, it is cleaned up to standard, or no, it's not. And again, that is then finalized, and we go into the court, it is resolved by the court. If there's agreement between all the parties, presumably it goes forward smoothly. If we feel that it has not been cleaned up, the responsible party could ask the court to be able to certify that which we were unwilling to certify. Otherwise, we would in fact order additional cleanup activity. Now, if there's somebody that's aggrieved by the determination, the certification process, that is, may be sought judicial review through that court sanctioned consent decree.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kintai.
Could you give me a little further definition of what an aggrieved person would be, how broad that would be?
Legal term.
Now, Senator, Chairman, members of the committee. That would usually be a question of standing. As in a normal civil action in a court, an example here perhaps would be a neighbor to the property that was being cleaned up. If they felt that the department would sign off on something less than complete cleanup, they might meet the requirements of standing, allowing them to go to court and challenge that decision.
So it'd have to be someone fairly close to the situation,
that
really affected.
That'd be one reading, Senator, and I'm not saying that a court might not allow a public interest group or somebody that doesn't live in the area to challenge that decision in court. Otherwise, another person aggrieved, of course, would include the party that did the cleanup. This umbrella phrase folds them in also and would give them a right to judicial review of the director's decision.
Maybe one other thing, though, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kintai, you may want to comment upon at what point do you think you'd have to have standing? At the end of the process, can you assert standing or some discussion of that issue?
It would be asserted at the end of the process after the final certification decision. As a practical matter, persons have a better chance of being let into court if they participated in the administrative record, for instance, these opportunities for public comment and review. Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's important, however, that again, this is on subsection C that begins on line 9 of page 36. That we talk about when the department makes that certification that a site is clean, that the decision of the director shall be upheld unless the person challenging the certification decision demonstrates that the decision was arbitrary and capricious, contrary to the provisions of this act, or not supported by substantial evidence. The court shall apply a presumption in favor of the director's decision. What we're trying to do is we're trying to be able to get those issues resolved early and not get issues tied up in the courts. And so the attempt is there.
Can I ask a question? I'm not on the judiciary. What does it mean when you say the court shall apply a presumption in favor of the director's decision? Is that sort of like we're presumed to be constitutional unless you can prove otherwise?
I'll let the attorney answer that.
That's a good characterization, Senator. In administrative practice, or when you're talking about state government, it means that the court defers to the expertise of the agency that's been charged with that subject matter. Here it's DEQ, hazardous waste. Because of the technicality and complexity of the issues, a court will usually defer or give deference, presumption, to that agency decision. I guess we could characterize it as stacking the deck, even though it's only a presumption that it could be rebutted.
That same subsection, by the way, does indicate that if somebody is using this process to drag out the taking any action, that the court may assess penalties equal to the economic gain realized by the company. That would be a court decision, not a department decision. Okay, so that's the agreement process. Enter into the agreement, take it to the court and get it blessed, march yourself through that cleanup, taking out certain parties, covenants not to sue, all affected parties. You get the cleanup completed, and at the end of the process, you go back to the court and say, okay, certified clean, and you move on. Again, not subject, except for those settings, to be able to be appealable. What we're trying to be able to avoid is that you end up having a situation where the department orders a cleanup, and all you do, instead of getting a cleanup, you just get it appealed straight up on up through either the contested case process to the commission or onto the appeals court, or taking it straight into a court setting. So we're trying to be able to minimize that and to get forward on cleanup, but allowing those parties to be able to come back into the department and either get cost recovery, or if we've been capricious or arbitrary, to be able to recover from us. Again, the idea of trying to get voluntary agreements rather than trying to be able to force things to happen. Okay. Section 19 deals with contractor liability. One of the big problems at the federal level is if contractors won't go out and clean up a hazardous waste site, if they're going to be liable, or at least there's been concern. Section 19 in subsection 1A is that they shall not be liable for non-negligent action.
Can I assume that contractor is defined back in the definition section to mean someone who cleans up?
Yeah, actually it's in
the end of this section
rather than the definition, but yes, it is. And it's, again, the person who cleans it up. A cleanup, by the way, I should stress, anybody who's like a RCRA facility, anybody who's regulated under a RCRA facility is specifically exempted from being subject to or receiving the contractor liability protections here. So they're not subject to negligent, they're not liable for negligent or non-negligent acts. They are liable for negligent acts. However, later on in this section, we provide in some cases that they can even be exempted for negligent acts. Not grossly negligent, but negligent acts. The reason is that they would then be funded, the liability would be picked up by the fund, and that is, again, parallel to the federal law, to ensure that if you're not going to get a cleanup, because no contractor will take a chance on even getting sued on the negligent, that you potentially can provide that. I think we're reluctant to be able to do that. That is a parallel to federal law in that regard. But it is there. And the key issue is on that is in subsection 3A, which says the director may agree to hold harmless and indemnify contractor meeting the requirements for negligence arising, unless such liability was effectively grossly negligent. Okay.
Well, with that in there, mm-hmm. Why would a contractor ever get involved in cleaning up stuff without this exemption?
To be able to make such findings, we'd have to find that there was no insurance available, that they were pursuing the insurance. What basically we have is under a subsection B, that...
B. Oh.
3 sub B. No.
D.
Sub D, pardon me. Yes, pardon me, sub D of that subsection 3. An indemnification agreement may be provided under this section only if the director determines that each of the following requirements are met. That no insurance is available, diligent efforts to obtain insurance are being pursued, that they continue to make such diligent efforts for such insurance. So it's really, if there is no insurance, you still have to move ahead with a cleanup, and you're not going to get anybody to do it, then this provision can be used, the indemnification provisions.
Okay.
Again, ties into the liability issues that you're all well familiar with. Okay. I've mentioned the fact that RCRA facilities would not be covered by the contractor. They cannot function as a contractor under this, so they cannot be held liable. The definitions of the... Pardon? Okay. Okay. So on the bottom of page, no, about the middle of page, top of page, pardon me, 41 is the definition of contract, and therefore what, Mr. Chairman, you were asking about. Okay, I'm going to jump ahead. We amend some existing law just to be able to bring it into conformity. There are just other repealers I'm not sure they're worthwhile commenting upon specifically unless there are questions. Next would be section 22. And for the purposes of providing public information, we do provide that a list identifying where releases have been confirmed will be provided. Again, this is on page 45, section 22. And one thing I'd like to point you to is that the last section on that, which is a subsection, which is page 47 at the top of the page, indicates that nothing in this section, however, including the listing of facility in the inventory or commission review of such listings, shall be construed to be a prerequisite to or otherwise affect the authority of the director to undertake, order, or authorize the removal or remedial action under this act. So what we're trying to do is provide some level of public information about this, but wanting to make sure that the decisions for cleanup are not driven by this, by that listing. That is, that we may in fact pursue potentially responsible parties, whether or not it's yet listed. Whether yet
how much, Fred, how much of this information do we have today?
In terms of confirmed releases?
Yeah.
We have 200 plus sites that are on the list that that's an EPA list. Al, maybe you can run through the breakdown of those and what categories they are.
Mr. Chairman, I think the we had some figures with our original testimony in the bill, and I don't recall those right now. In general, on some sites, we have a lot of information where there's been a lot of testing. At some sites where there has been no sampling, there really is no information other than allegations or suspicions, and that really would not be a confirmation. I think in general, maybe 50-50. The sites that we're aware of, we have some information. Others, we don't have at all or very little. That's a rough estimate, but I have to go back and look at their original numbers on our testimony.
Well, let me ask you this. We had a list, I think it was of 200 potential. They weren't confirmed, but they were potential sites. Now, are you basically saying that we can't answer the questions that this bill asked to be answered on those sites today? And we need to do a lot more characterization on those sites to be able to answer these questions?
Right.
In section 22?
Yeah, to date, right now, EPA and DQ has conducted of the preliminary assessments at 154 of those sites. Of these 154, EPA has concluded that no further action is necessary at this time for 59 of the sites, 59 of the 154. However, site investigations are pending or underway at the remaining 95 sites. Additionally, more than 50 sites await a preliminary assessment of the potential health hazards. Okay.
And how did you arrive at that initial list of 200?
Al, you were
Mr. Chairman.
The list has been a living list, if you will, since about 1978 when EPA began this program. Initially, there were a couple studies that Congress directed and a couple surveys various congressional committees established to get at, try to find out where are all these abandoned sites. And that resulted in beginning of a list. There was a one-time notification required for all contaminated sites in 1981 after the Federal Superfund was passed. All owners and operators of facilities that had a release were required to report that release. In Oregon, that resulted in about 30 to 40 sites coming to our attention, placed on the list of 200. There have been sites that where past practices have been uncovered during our routine inspections of under other programs, air quality, water quality, or hazardous waste inspection at a facility,
may uncover information about a past practice or a past disposal area. There's been cases where employees of companies, businesses would call up and report about a past practice. It's actually a variety of mechanisms of information.
How would you characterize your list right now of 200? Do you consider it a comprehensive list? Do you consider it a kind of a random list? Do you consider it one that we have developed in a conscious and conscientious way? Or how would you characterize the list of these 200 sites?
Maybe I'll take a crack at it first. I think that we all recognize that that list is not 100% identifying all the sites, not even 95%. It certainly is a beginning and probably represents, I think we all feel probably fairly confident it represents at least half of the sites that are out there. I hope we feel that confident on that. But it has come through in a number of different ways, and we have looked at things such as the type of businesses, metal plating businesses, for example, are high on the list of potential types of businesses, and researching records, telephone books, and other things to be able to identify those has come forward. We believe, however, that a site investigation, site discovery effort needs to be taken aggressively, and we do intend, if we receive resources, to do that during the next biennium, during this upcoming biennium. But we clearly believe that, yes, that is not the universe by any means.
If we receive the resources, what are we talking about?
Well, we would expect that if, in fact, this program moves forward, that one of the priorities that I would establish within the department is efforts to be able to look at what those potential sites are. And I would expect that as we come into the next biennium, that we will have a good handle on the universe of all possible sites within Oregon. Not to say that there aren't going to be some exceptions, but that we really do expect that that will, in fact, be able to be accomplished over the next biennium. And that we will then, at some stage, again, depending upon funding level, do some portion of those site assessments. Again, those site assessments can be expensive if they're having to be done by us. If they are, in fact, responsible parties that are on those sites, then you obviously are asking them to take certain actions, and it is less resource intensive.
What kind of, there's a bunch of money that comes into you from 122 because of the Arlington fee. What kind of money, what portion of that money would you expect to be using for site assessment, site identification?
Chairman, hard to be able to estimate, I think, clearly on that. Alan, you come up with at least some initial numbers on how much individuals we devote just actually to the site discovery side. Maybe you can comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, in our governor's recommended budget, I believe there's between 1 and 2 work years identified for site assessment and preliminary site discovery. That effort primarily would be in our regional offices, which generally are the front line and, if you will, that receives information about past practices.
Is that new FTEs, or is that just an expectation of additional work by people who are already in the field?
Mr. Chairman, those are new FTEs that are in our budget for that activity.
Okay. Now, whether we would end up shifting workloads so that we use some of the people that are experienced already out there who have some knowledge of it,
I don't really. I certainly know that people who are in my area have plenty to do as it is.
Yep.
I don't know about the rest of the state, but I know in my area they have plenty to do. Can you get me an answer as to whether you're talking 1 FTE or 2 FTE? Between 1 and 2, give me an answer on that. Not right this minute, but soon, okay?
We'll be happy to. What is reflecting the governor's budget, I would like to stress, though, is probably at this stage, given kind of the time that has taken place since the budget was submitted and now, is that does not put as much emphasis on site discovery as I feel that we're going to need to be able to do during the next biennium, and we would no doubt be shifting additional resource into that area above and beyond what's even in the governor's recommended budget.
I just want to, as you know, this is a fairly major concern to me from our prior meetings, and I think we're going to need to get a pretty clear indication of what your intentions are in your proposals to Ways and Means, because I think this committee has a very significant interest in that issue.
We will do that, Mr. Chairman. Let me again stress, though, that my expectation is that when we are before you in 2 years from now, that we will be able to tell you with confidence that what we have as the universe of possible sites is exhaustive. That's not to say that there aren't going to be the exceptional site that gets added here and there, but that we really expect to be able to have a handle on that universe.
Okay. I applaud that goal. I want to see how you're going to get there.
Quickly to finish off the bill, Section 23, which is on page 47, establishes an advisory committee. It is an advisory committee, statutorily required advisory committee, to the development of rules for the implementation of the program.
Okay.
Section 24 deals with the fact that any actions taken under the agreements that we reach to be able to have cleanup shall be published in papers of general circulation and so on, so that people have a chance to be able to comment upon those. Sections 26 through 29 are effectively dealing with if, in fact, Senate Bill 115 is enacted, that we don't duplicate, that without knowing which bills are going to get enacted, although we trust all of them will be, we have similar sections in each bill. And then Section 30 is the...
Well, let me explain now. What are you amending? Tell me what Section 25 does.
Okay.